to interrupt such lovely chanting. I remember the day that Sri Krishna who's leading in this recording, is Papa's grandnephew, and he came up to me during the day and he says, "Are you going to be at Bhajan tonight?" And I said, "Yes, of course." And he says, "I'm teaching everyone a new Ramdam." It was this version here. He says, "It's the best that's ever been." Of course, everybody has their favorites, but it's a lovely version of Ramdam. And we can chant that and chant it, and it will help to purify body, mind, and soul. It will start to lift us into higher regions of thought and consciousness. And there is something about it, a power that is there, that has the capacity to take us all the way to our realization and our oneness with God. Papa did this, and he showed that it was possible just simply chanting this name of God, keeping our minds focused on God's presence and the power of his name. You know, when you start to chant this, in the beginning, you're just chanting it out loud. But then you start to feel a kind of vibration that goes along with the sound. It's a lovely thing. And it makes you feel good. And it makes you feel closer to God. And then you continue to chant it, and then the power of God starts to run through your being. And this is a most wonderful experience because it is blissful. And it uplifts you. And it changes you. It changes you down to the very cellular level of your body. It begins to align you with divine consciousness. We have been given some of the greatest tools ever to be presented with mankind for achieving God consciousness. And this is one of them, because we cannot do Kriya all of the time. So then we chant, we do Hongsa, we do those things that we have been taught. And once we feel the divine presence inside and we feel that inner guidance beginning to take us over, then we surrender to that divine presence. This is a totally new way of living in this world. In the beginning, we follow Moses, the lawgiver, and he gives us the do's and the don'ts. And they aren't there to punish us or to make us feel bad, but rather they are principles upon which we can build our life. And if we do so, we benefit from it. And if we go against those principles, we suffer because of it. But there is a higher principle, a higher law than the one Moses gave. If you'll notice in the telling of the story, Moses came all the way up to the Holy Land, brought the people out of Egypt of darkness and all the way there to where they are going to establish a new kingdom, a kingdom in God. But Moses himself did not make that transition. He left the body beforehand, and symbolically, this means we transcend the law because we enter into the divine consciousness, one that Jesus had, so that he sometimes went against the laws, and there are those who found fault with him. And yet he knew that God's inner guidance was more prevalent, more what he should be doing than simply following the law as it has been given down in the past. This is tricky territory, because unless we're truly attuned to God, we can get into big trouble, becoming a law to ourselves from an ego standpoint. It's very, very different than becoming a law unto ourselves due to our total surrender and consummation in with God consciousness. Did not intend to give such a long introduction, but now if you'll pray with me.
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved
Jesus Christ,
Blessed
Master,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles,
and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Oh. Oh. Peace.
Peace.
Bliss.
Bliss.
Amen. Amen. Reading from the posting today, The Unseen Elephant in the Room. There's an unstudied phenomenon by modern science that, once it comes on its radar, it will be one of those things that seems so obvious, it's a wonder there was no recognition of it before. This phenomenon is all around us. In fact, it is fundamental to all existence. It is the life force existing in all creation, what yogis of India call prana. In human beings, we sense this life force or the lack of it in one another. Someone walks in a room, and they are like a spark plug that raises the level of life energy in everyone. Then again, there are those who are like black holes of energy, draining energy from those around them. Creativity, making things happen, bringing in new ideas, awakening the feeling of God and the sacredness of life, all these are products of life energy, and everyone has some gift of this life force to offer to this world. To some to a wider extent, others in a quieter way. And we can feel that power both in ourselves and in others. In the same way, we can sense this in people, so we perceive. In the same way that we can sense this in people, so we perceive it in nature. There are places in the world that stirs life energy. Next to rushing water, we feel invigorated. Or, next to a fetid, unmoving water, we sense its deadness. Walking through some forest, we feel the upright strength of trees growing all around us. And in other places, the sickly rot or burned-out hulks of a forest that is past its prime. Even in a sickly area, there are microbes and insects that feed off the death and are preparing the forest for a rebirth. And on that level, there's a great deal of life energy at work, even in its destruction. Mystics and yogis have long recognized the role of life energy, while physical scientists have largely focused on the many avenues that life energy works through, such as studying the subatomic and atomic worlds, molecules, microbes, insects, sap, photosynthesis, cellular functions, body organs, and interactions between life forms. And while all of these fields of study are fascinating, there is an elephant in the room most do not see, and that is the life energy that animates all the outward manifestations that can be seen under a microscope or a telescope or what is before our eyes. Those who have investigated the interiors of consciousness clearly see this elephant, and it is life force. Yogis have specialized for millennia in observation and conscious use of life force prana. Master brought to the West a rational understanding of this force based on his own experience and drawing upon traditions explained to him by his great guru, Sri Yukteswarji, who was in turn taught by Lari Mahashai, who was taught by Babaji. We learn that this life force enters the body primarily through the base of the skull, and from there it enters the brain and is distributed throughout the body by the spine and the nervous system. These physical mechanisms are conduits through which life energy operates, but the underlying force and intelligence are not the conduits, but the prana itself. In addition to the normal functions in man and in nature, prana plays an active role in the next evolutionary step in man, transforming the human to the divine. In this area, yogis of India have made a specialty. Master brought a refined technique called Kriya Yoga to the West. He writes, "By the special technique of Kriya Yoga, the ingoing breath of prana and the outgoing breath of apana are converted into cool and warm currents. In the beginning of the practice of Kriya Yoga, the devotee feels the cool prana current going up the spine and the warm apana current going down the spine. When the Kriya Yogi learns to dissolve the ingoing and the outgoing breath into a perception of the cool and warm currents going up and down the spine, he feels his body as sustained by these inner currents of life force and not by their byproduct of breath. This practice of Kriya Yoga awakens the practitioner to the reality that they are made up of this life energy, and further, an even more refined understanding leads the practitioner to a subtler reality. All life energy is divine in nature, ringing out with the qualities of bliss, peace, universal love, and light. Fortunately, we do not need to wait for the snail-like pace of physical science to discover all this. We can explore these frontiers today in the laboratories of our own experience. As a practitioner of this science, even as I turn my attention within, I'm aware of the prana vitality vibrating throughout, and I experience that this body is not a physical being as much as a life energy being, not defined by the physical limits, but it is vast in nature. Bliss fills this space, freedom, and a knowingness that I am part of all and all is part of me. It is a seamless transition, like that moving smoothly from a river to the river entering the ocean. Now, you have been given a great gift, but you must fully employ the means given to you so freely. Make the most of this spiritual science for the realization of God and becoming living proof of what you have been taught. Know that you are truly made up of God stuff, and then be a conduit through which that same power and intelligence that creates vast worlds is now fully operating in you. Bring this world to its next evolutionary step and discover its true underlying divinity. Amazed that it somehow had been blind to this elephant in the room. Reading from Master's Commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 5, Stanza 1. Arjuna said, O Krishna, you speak of renunciation of actions. At the same time, you welcome their performance. Which is the better path? Please tell me. Arjuna, like many another true devotee, is not yet free from the perplexities. When a yogi begins to meditate deeply, he is so happy with the new world of inner perceptions that he wonders, should I ever return to activity in this world? Should I not rather confine myself wholly to the secluded meditation? These two paths have been the cause of many controversies. The initial romance with the infinite in the path of meditation is likely to make the devotee one-sided. He inclines to forsake the path of action. The cosmic law, however, compels man to activity, regardless of what mental determination he may entertain regarding his conduct in life. He who is part of creation has obligations toward creation. He who is part of creation has obligations toward creation. He is forced even ever again, his consciousness will to play his equitable parts, just as a man cannot successfully decide with his mind that he will stop breathing, so he cannot effectively decide with his mind that he will stop acting. And this is a very important point, because as we ascend up the spinal ladder of consciousness, we do come into that sense where I feel such peace when I am in deep meditation. I feel such expansiveness. And then when I open these two eyes and I seek to go out into this world, I seem to lose that inner beauty and wonder and upliftment. I seem to come down into consciousness. And so it is in the beginning. And so we must go through time and time again. And one of the lessons that we derive from this is that the inner spiritual kingdom is so much greater than the one that we have on the outside. But even though we have these wonderful experiences, we do open these eyes. Even if for a while our breath is suspended while in deepened meditation, the breath begins again. Because we are not done with the world and the world is not done with us. We have a role to play. We have something to do. This theme runs throughout the Gita where Arjuna is constantly wanting to withdraw from the field. And he doesn't want to have to enter into the action that is demanded upon him. And we all have that feeling at times. There are things we don't want to do in this life that we don't like. And that is true enough. But it doesn't extend from that necessarily that we should not be doing those things. Oftentimes those are the very things we should be entering into. Now, Lari Mahasaya made a very interesting point. He called Kriya Yoga itself Karma Yoga, Yoga of Action. And indeed it is. Because it is an act that is intended to free us. And not just Kriya Yoga, but everything that we do in this world, if we do it with an eye on the fact that it is there to free us, not to bind us. Now, we have to face the battlefield, and the battlefield will call to us to enter into old habits. We'll want to identify with this body and with the things that this body wants in this world. We may become greedy for a number of things. We might want to be greedy for things in our world, or money, or power, or position, or pleasure. And these are all attachments of the body. And so we must be cautious as we enter into this world. It is not that pleasure in itself is wrong. We take pleasure in many things, in the taste of good food, good company, the sunshine shining on us in an early morning. All of these things bring us pleasure. We also know that things of this world also bring us pain. And this is the thing that is always true. Whatever gives us pleasure will alternately also give us pain. We have just got to somehow reconcile ourselves to this fact. But it doesn't leave us on this teeter-totter of pleasure and pain forever. There is a superior pleasure. We chant the word Om or Amen. It is the divine vibration. It is the divine presence that is within us. And that lifts us beyond duality. In God, there is no opposite as there is in creation. In creation, there's always an opposite. But bliss has no opposite, as Swami Satchidananda pointed out. It is a pure, essential thing all in itself. It has no duality to it. Now, it is true we can be in a state of bliss or out of a state of bliss. But it's unlike other kinds of pleasures that come to us that has its opposite in pain because it comes from a different source. The pleasure and pain comes from this body. Bliss comes directly from God. And we can be sustained in this bliss. Bliss is that upliftment, that feeling of, there's just no other word for it, for bliss. You can describe it with many other things, but unless you've experienced it, you don't know it. And it doesn't do to make it linked with things of the senses because it's so totally different than that. But it is pure enjoyment in that sense. It is pure upliftment. It is the purity of light and goodness. And it just shines from you. It has no expectations, no desires. And when we enter into this state of bliss, then we are able to be in this world and not get attached to it. Ramakrishna talked about getting into jackfruit and carving into it, and it's very sticky apparently. I've never done it myself. But he said beforehand you rub oil all over your arms and your hands, otherwise the stickiness will stick to you and it's hard to get rid of, hard to wash it off. But if you have oil on you first, then it comes off rather easily. He said God's remembrance and God's presence is like that oil that you smear on your hands and your arm so that the sticky jackfruit doesn't stay with you. Rather, it just slides off. When you have the bliss of God, you still experience the things of this world. You might have pleasure and you might have pain. But the presence of God is more than that. And it is like that oil that goes on your arms and your hands so that you don't get attached to the things of this world. Now, as aspirants, we enter into this path, and it can be given as a certainty we will have attachments. There will be things that will come up, and we'll like some things and we'll dislike other things. And we can practice our dispassion. And that is what Krishna means by renunciation. It doesn't mean that you have to sit in a cave, because even if you sat in a cave someplace, and believe me, it's true, all of a sudden you take the world with you. And all the things that you're attached to in this world and all the things that are unresolved, suddenly they're invading your thoughts. St. Anthony in Egypt, when he heard the sermon in which Jesus said to sell everything and follow me, he took the words very literally, and he was the son of a wealthy man, and his family, his mother and his father, had died. He had a sister, so making sure that he had taken care of his sister, he sold everything and he gave it to the poor. And then he headed out and he went into caves, and he went into the catacombs where those who had died were buried. And it was a practice in Egypt at one time, so it is said, that when a king died, so all the servants were killed as well. Now, they may not have been willing participants in this program, but there they were. And killed they were. And when St. Anthony went into these catacombs, he experienced these dark negative forces. Maybe some of them were the fear and the anger and all the rest of it that these souls had when they were killed. But he also drew these dark, evil forces to him, and he really had to contend with them. And they came in energetic and physical ways, and they beat him so soundly one time that he was unconscious, and he was completely beaten up in his body, and he was even taken for dead. The man who brought him food went in and found him completely lifeless on the floor. And so he took him and he put him on a slab and dressed him in all the kinds of herbs that they would put people into. And suddenly he took a deep breath, St. Anthony did, and he came back to life. And immediately he marched right back into the catacombs where he had just experienced this death. He was so determined to face whatever it was that was to come. Now, to one degree or another, we do the same thing. When we enter into the catacombs of our own meditation chamber, the dead rise up to haunt us sometimes. They are our memories. They are those things that are unresolved from this lifetime and other lifetimes. And we have to face them. I remember one time, I was not particularly a fearful person, but when my meditation, I began to experience this tremendous fear. I just wanted to run away and to do anything but be on my meditation blanket. But day after day, I forced myself to go right back there. And I had to do it, you see. We all have to do it. If we get up and we run away, there's really no running away. These are things that are deep in our psyche. And any time that we turn within and we try to quiet the mind, they will come right back at us. So this is the time, this is the place for us to face these things. And sometimes we don't think we have the strength to do it. Sometimes it's what we're actually facing. Sometimes it's what we're afraid we'll have to face. But remember this. Whatever you have to face has already happened to you. It's in the long past. And you've already gone through it. And so while you may have to face the remnants, the echoes of that experience, you don't necessarily have to go through it again. And then God brings to us certain situations in this life. And they seem to be everything turning bad against us. You think of the life of Job. And Job was just minding his own business, and he's a good man, and he worshiped God. And it is said in the story that the devil and God were having a conversation one day. That's an interesting fact in itself, isn't it? That the devil and God are talking. And they're talking along, and the devil says, "There's nobody who really loves you in this world, you know." That's the way the devil is. And God says, "Oh, yes, there are." And he said, "Show me. Show me just one person who really loves you." God said, "Job loves me." God says, the devil said, "Job's got everything going his way. He's got money. He's got wealth. He's got a lovely family. What's there to complain about? He's got good health. Of course he loves you. People can love you in the summertime of life. What about the wintertime? What if things were to go wrong?" And the story goes on to say that God and the devil made a bet about Job. And they decided to test him, that the devil would test him. Now that doesn't seem very fair to Job, does it? He's just minding his own business. But suddenly all these things started to happen to Job. Wealth got taken away, health got taken away, family was interfered with. And true enough, he groaned at different times. We all do at times, you know, when this body or things in this world aren't going well. Sometimes we feel like a very heavy load is being driven over us, and we're the bridge. And the bridge creaks and groans as this heavy load's going over it. And so sometimes that happens, and you might creak and groan a little bit as these things happen. But overall, Job stayed true to God. He did not turn away from him. He would complain to him. And there again, we can complain to God. "Lord, why are you doing these things to me? Isn't this enough? Why do you seem to have a target painted on me and all these bad things are happening?" And yet, this is God, through the devil, testing us, seeing if our love is true or not. And Job's was, and eventually he came out of it. And his life was all right. Now we know that everything happens in a lawful manner. And that things that come to us are of our own doing. This has been proven to me many, many times. Were things that I was going through, and then God lifted me up and he showed me some previous incarnation, or perhaps it was connected with this incarnation. But you know, so many things that affected me in this incarnation are connected with past incarnations. There's a reason why you react to situations and people in the way that you do, even at a young age. And we know from observation that young babies will have their own personalities right from the get-go. And as we develop and as we grow, it triggers different past life memories. As we get a certain age, then something from a past life suddenly comes to us. And we have to deal with that. And to somebody else, it seems like a snap. It seems so easy. But to us, it's something that may plague us our entire lifetime if we don't go to work and change it. Make that determination if you're facing things in your life. As Mother used to say, Rome was not built in a day, neither do you get your God realization in a short amount of time. We are here to do that work. But make the determination inside of you, if it takes me from now until eternity, I will never give up. I will continue to address this issue until I have mastered it. God inside of me is all powerful, is all wise, all knowledgeable. And therefore, I have the greatest resource inside of me. As a human being, I may not be up to it. But God inside of me is. And I draw upon that power. I draw upon that intelligence. I draw upon everything that is inside of me that is God. You must do this, God, if it is to be done. I cannot of myself do anything. Jesus himself said that. I of myself am nothing. It is my Father who doeth the works. And we come to realize that through the test that we are put through, because every one of us will be brought to a breaking point. That is to say, a point where we have extended everything that we are as a human being, and still we have not been able to overcome what it is that we're being given to deal with. And that is when we draw upon God. We surrender to him. Before that, there's always a little part of us who's hanging on to the idea, I can do this on my own. One time God gave me the image, it's such a sweet thing, of a little child who is trying to do a certain thing on the floor. And the mother came up, and the child was getting very, very frustrated and not being able to do this. And the mother came up and said, let me just guide your hands here. No. I want to do this. I want to do it, stubborn child said, shaking the mother's hands off. Mother backed away. Of course, is not going to enforce herself on helping this child. Finally, the child cries and pouts and does everything that it can do. And it finally surrenders. And it says, Mama, will you help me? And then the mother gladly, so gladly, reaches in and guides the child's hands and says, see, if you just do this and if you just do that, then it all comes together. And then the child is so happy. And that is the way that we are. We throw off the hands that I've got it. Never mind. Sometimes things are going smoothly in our life, and we go, I don't have any need for God here. I'm just going to do it myself. And then we get ourselves into a royal pickle. And it's all our own doing. I've done this many times, many, many times. I remember there were times when I felt that nothing that I did would be a problem, because I felt God's presence so greatly. And there were even a few times when my mind wandered off from God and I didn't suffer from anything. And so I began to think, well, I'm there. I've got it. I can do what I want. And it was a slippery slope, I can tell you. Down I went. And then suddenly I realized I was in trouble. I had forgotten God. It was all on my own. And I can tell you, that's a humbling moment. You realize how tricky this mind is. How tricky desire nature is. How easy it is to put aside this issue of surrender and renunciation and letting go. So Krishna says here, we must act. Master says here, we must act as long as we breathe. We are in action. As long as your heart pumps, you are in activity. As long as you have consciousness of this world. Now, God has put me into an interesting state in this last period of time. Because as God's minister, it has been my duty to serve. And I've had a certain conception of what that service means. It's giving services, it's giving talks like this, it's talking to individuals and writing to them and going back and forth and helping them in all the ways that I had seen Mother do and also Master, and I had a certain idea of that. And then God started to withdraw me from this world. Been over 30 years of service of the other sort. And he started to make me more inward, and there was a part of my mind that was uncomfortable with that. But shouldn't I be doing this other sort of service? And God's consistent message was, no. I'm drawing you unto myself. And in one sense, I don't need that, because I feel God, whether I'm in activity or not activity. I feel him the same. And so of myself, I don't need that. But he does certain things through this form. And he works through it in certain ways. And you can believe that or not, but it's true. And he's demonstrated it to me many, many times. And that there is no barriers of time nor space. I think of someone, and my thoughts very easily glide over time and space. And I feel my communion with that one, and I feel God serving that one in what I am doing at that moment. Not I doing it, but God doing it inside of me. Because what would I know to do? And so sometimes he responds to individuals, and sometimes he doesn't. And I can tell you that is a test for me, because I think perhaps that I should be responding to everyone. I noted that there were times when Papa, too, began to withdraw. When Mother was there, he said he wasn't going to write letters anymore. He'd written all he needed to say or had to say, and he wasn't going to write that way anymore. Master, too, he withdrew into the desert, and he is working on his commentaries and whatever else work that God was doing through him at the time. And so this is the way that it is. Mother even herself at one point retired. And she asked me to take over things completely. And so there are different seasons. There are different times for things. And maybe the season will change and he will make me more active again. I don't know. All I can say is this is the way that he's making me do now. And as I say, at different times, it's a point of surrender for me. Because I have my own idea of what I think I should be doing in service. When Mother first made me a minister, I wasn't sure how that title fit with me. Sometimes we have a conception of a minister as a holier-than-thou or somebody who gets up and gives these fiery sermons and so on. And I knew none of that fit me well at all. And for some weeks or maybe longer, I was really going to God and saying, how does this fit for me? And I picked up the dictionary one day, and one of the things was to minister, to serve. And I thought, I can do that. I can serve. And Mother had asked me to talk to different individuals, and she started to ask me to give talks. I remember one time she asked me if I wanted to work with a certain individual. She says, I've tried for years and there's been no change at all. Why don't you give it a shot? So she wanted to give me a challenge right out of the blocks. I too worked for years with that individual and I didn't see much changes. And it taught me a valuable lesson that we have to want to change. No one can change us for us. You can't change anyone. What you can offer them is God in yourself. You can offer them the light of God, the joy of God, the bliss of God, the peace of God. If God so chooses, you can offer them the wisdom that he chooses to give through you. You can pray for all people. You can see them held in God's light. If there's a 911 emergency and the aid cars are going by, you can chant Ram Nam for those who are going to give their service and through their aid and those who are going to be aided. You can give God's light to this world and see this world surrounded and filled with that light. People uplifted everywhere. People who are in difficult situations in different geographies or different social or political situations. And we can label people and we can find blame with them, or we can pray for them. Isn't it a wonderful idea? Instead of gossiping, instead of thinking ill of different people, maybe those are the very people who need your prayers the most. And rather than developing a holier-than-thou attitude towards those that you might find fault with, wouldn't it be better to pray for those individuals? I remember reading a book many years ago, and he talked about shooting prayers at people. And he was on the bus, and there was somebody who's having obvious difficulty, and he was shooting prayers at them while he was sitting in the bus. And everywhere he went, he was shooting prayers at people. And it's an interesting idea. Now, I prefer to think of holding people in the light and seeing them filled with it. But for him, shooting prayers was exactly the right thing. The main point is you're releasing the God inside of you to be a benefit to this world. And when you are doing that, you've got your mind on God. But if you're finding fault and criticism, and you are just complaining about the things of this world, are you seeing God in all of that? Or is that the human ego in you who thinks it stands a little bit above? Can be a little arrogant in there. You know, it's really something to analyze in ourselves and to go to work on if we find any truth in it. We have walked in the footsteps of every person on this earth. If we see ego and arrogance, you can depend on it. We've done it at some time or another ourselves, in this life or another. If we see cruelty, if we see any sort of thing that disturbs us, distresses us, that we don't like, it's our opportunity to help. Now, sometimes we give more material kind of help, physical aid, or money, or something else to help somebody along on their way. But the greatest thing you can give is the light and the love of God. When I first met Mother, she hugged everyone after she gave a talk. Now today, we see that hugging has really gone into vogue through high school students. When I was in high school, you wouldn't have ever thought of hugging other kids. That would have been the furthest thing from your mind. But today you see it quite often. And when Mother did it, it was absolutely novel. And when I went up to hug her the first time, my heart was beating so hard. And then I felt that great love of God just sweep into me. And I would feel it every time. And this is the capacity you have. You don't actually have to touch someone. You can just think on them. And you can give them a mental hug. You can give them the light and love of God inside of you. Mother would say she would give us all the love of God, fully and completely. But you know, many of us are not in command of our own hearts. I was not. And Mother called me on it. And she said, unless you love me completely, you cannot have God realization. And it really called me on the carpet. I had to do something about it. And I struggled with it because I wasn't sure I wanted to go that route. And eventually I made that decision. If that's the only way I can get God realization, then I'll do it. And then I started reading two different books. One was about St. Francis, and the other is about Ramakrishna, both great bhaktis, both great lovers of God. And my heart started to open. It was a creaky, painful process, but it started to happen. And then God came in and he flowed through this heart. And then he just blasted all the doors wide off. There's no stopping him then. And I've never regretted it. You know, thinking back on it, I've never regretted anything about this path. Mother asked me to give up all drugs, all alcohol, no sex without benefit of marriage, no smoking of cigarettes or anything else. And you know, I've never regretted one of those things, quite the opposite. Every one of those have been angels that have stood on my shoulders and helped me. I don't think I would have ever been an alcoholic. That wasn't in my makeup. But I know I would have, through tough times, I would have drank too much. I know that. I know for a fact, because I can see and feel the differences in my body. I can feel the changes in my cellular system. And I know that I would not have the realization of God, whatever that is, that I have today, if I were drinking or smoking or using any sorts of drugs at all. it would not be possible. So everything that she taught, everything that she asked of me, she did not ask for herself. She did it because she knew that that would be best for us. She knew it because that would be the highway to the infinite. And not have to go through so many byways and goat trails and swamps, so much we could avoid. Now we still have to go through things, it's true. But we avoid so much by not making those same mistakes time and time again. This human body, not just in the physical, but in the energetic, the mental, the causal, the spiritual, it is tremendous. It really is. And its capacity is beyond imagination. Because it has the capacity to know and experience and express God consciousness. This is a tremendous thing, and yet most of the world acts as if it doesn't exist. Even like the life energy that flows through plants and animals and human beings. Withdraw that life force from this body. You can stuff food into the mouth. You can try to pump oxygen into the lungs. It's not going to operate. Because the life is gone. The life energy is no longer there to sustain it. And this is a fact, and yet most people act as if it's just a nothing. And then we can call upon this life energy through Kriya and through meditation. We can draw the life energy up through the spine and to the higher regions of the mind and of the brain. And suddenly we feel this enlightening presence. And we go, my goodness, this has been inside of me all the time. No wonder I was so dissatisfied with the things of the world. No wonder I couldn't find fulfillment in all of the things that I searched for out there. This is perfect and it's beautiful. I remember one time walking down this tree-lined street. And God was pervading everything. I felt God in the trees that were in this avenue. I felt it in the sidewalk, in the grass, the houses, the people, everything. And I had a funny thought come to me. I thought, this is for free? That's a funny thought, isn't it? But it's true. It's like I would give anything to have this experience continuously. And it's for free. It's part of my nature. It's part of my inheritance from my Heavenly Father. And yet the really interesting thing, I know there were many devotees who had tremendous experiences. Tremendous. And then they walked away from the path somehow as if it was nothing. And you understand then how it can be for Papa, his fear that he might forget God when he was in his sadhana. He actually had a fear of that. And you can understand why when you see those who really are tremendous souls. They really are. They have tremendously uplifting experiences. And then they can walk away from it all as if it was nothing. You realize how precious this desire for God is. It can be painful at times. It certainly can be. But how precious it is that we should have this feeling, this desire for God alone. And how we should do everything in our power to nurture it, to bring it out, to practice those things that we have been taught. Not to treat any of it carelessly. Like we could just drop the most valuable jewel in the world on the ground and not even be aware of it. Not even think about it. And that is what we are like when we treat God carelessly. When we don't put God first. It says it in a rather strange way in the Old Testament that our God is a jealous God. But here's the truth of that. And it has to do with our minds. that if we don't value God above all other things, above all other images, then those things and images will grow because of the energy and attention that we've given to it. And it will take over our lives and we will lose God. So you can see in that sense how in old language perhaps you might say God is a jealous God. God isn't jealous in the sense that he needs anything from you. God is God. God has everything already. But it's us. It's our attention and our intention. So let us not forget that. I wanted to read from the journal something that Master had written that I think is beautiful and very true. And it's entitled, Some Treasure of My Own. Whenever I tried to give you, I found whatever I tried to give you, I found was yours. So I threw away the flowers from the altar. I put out the candles in the temple, that I may offer you some treasure of my own. Searching on the paths of my heart, I found some perennial plants of my innate craving for you. For you are mine, and 'tis my free choice to love you as mine. Even though love come from you, and was your gift into me. Isn't that beautiful? Beautiful, because even though Master is acknowledging here, and it's very true, we cannot love God if God did not love us first. He gives us that love for him. Even then, there's a certain something inside. I choose to give this love to you. And therefore, even though it's your love, I'm making that choice, and that choice is the one thing that I can say is mine, perhaps. I know since you gave me your love, that love was no longer yours. So I want to love you with your given love, now belonging to me alone. Alas, I know your gift of love was not given with command to love you alone. I could have used your love, loved only your gifts forever, or saturate love in the material life. Now I will pick the flowers of love growing in the perennial plants of my soul treasure amidst the garden of incarnations and lay them in the temple of your heart, for they alone are mine. Of my own accord, I love you. Through my own desire, I prefer you to your pet gifts. And I will use the free choice to offer you all of my love. 'Tis you alone and nothing else. You are mine. You must receive what's mine. And I think that's just beautiful. Just beautiful. Because we can have that personal sense then with God. This is something that I give to you. You gave it to me first. But I choose to give it to you. I could choose to turn my attention elsewhere. But I choose you. Now love is the most powerful force in this world. More powerful than anything else. And so when you love God and you give him everything that is yours, including your love, then you become an open channel in which God gives back to you even greater love, even greater power, even greater light, greater bliss. The more you give, the more you receive. And you think, why wouldn't I give it of my all? And surely we can if we choose to. So let us not ignore the elephant in the room. Let us not act as if it is not there and is with us in every room, every place that we go. For God is truly there. Let us tune in to that life force. If we start to feel a little bit ill, out of sorts, moody, instead of indulging in the mood or in the illness, then open yourself to God. Open yourself to that life force, the purity, the light, the the joy. Let it flow in, and particularly let it flow into any of those parts that are afflicted, any that are feeling despondency. Open yourself to that light. Let it stream into you. The hate, the darkness cannot abide by the light. It hates the light. And when you open yourself to that light and you feel and see that light entering into you, darkness flees. It must. And so you choose God all through the day, no matter what comes to you. And if you're feeling pain in your body, then just feel, all right, God, this is you, come to me in your form, in that particular form right now. And then you've linked your mind to God. Pain is no longer an obstacle, but is a manifestation of the infinite, or loneliness, or sadness, or desire nature, whatever form it comes in. And you feel God's presence, God's love, God's light come, even though apparently on the outside, it doesn't seem to be manifesting that light or that love or that bliss. But when you co-mingle the two, it takes the darkness out of whatever that experience is, and it brings you into the light. So let us gladly embrace the elephant in the room. He's a friendly elephant, and he loves you. And he'll pick you up on his trunk and put you on his back and take you down the trail towards your full realization. Now will you pray with me? O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty
of
thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet
and surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection
surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with thy light.
Fill me with thy bliss.
Pour thy love through me.
And let me be an emissary
of your presence,
of your being,
of your love,
forever and forever.
To the great light of God within you.